Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William & Mary and this station. Today's guest is Karen Hall, a William & Mary graduate and current story editor for the television series MASH. Our topic, writing for TV. How did you break into the field of television script writing?
I started writing when I was in undergraduate school, and I wrote one-act plays and a spec script for MASH, and I took a trip to California that summer and happened to meet Alan Alda and showed him my work, and he was really enthusiastic about it. So we stayed in touch for about 3 years, and one day he called me out of the clear blue sky and said that MASH was looking for an outside writer and that they really wanted a woman, and he had mentioned me, so I submitted some scripts to them, and they liked them. They called me in to pitch story ideas, and I did, and they liked one of my ideas and gave me the assignment to write it.
Well, what kinds of pressure do you face working with a weekly television show?
Part of the challenge of writing for television is that there are so many pressures from so many different directions, the pressures of keeping all the actors happy because it's their face that's on the screen, and so then there are time pressures constantly because the script has to be done in time. I remember the first time I went and asked somebody for an extension on a script, they looked at me like I'm crazy because the script shoots tomorrow. There's no such thing as an extension. So there's time pressure. There's network pressure. There are like 15 different people you have to please. There's such a hierarchy. There are producers and directors and actors, and then there's a network, and the network has the advertisers, and so there are always people above you pressuring you to get things the way they want them.
As a story editor, do you find yourself writing original scripts very often?
I have so far. I think that a lot of story editors spend their time doing only rewrites, but I've been lucky enough so far that I've spent most of my time writing my own scripts. I only had a few occasions to rewrite someone else's.
Do you often use your own experience as the basis for situations you create in these stories?
Constantly. I think, I don't know where, you know, other writers draw their ideas, but I can almost always find something in something that's happened to me or a way that I have felt about something and put it into the characters. I try to get my ideas from the characters that I have and think what would happen in this character's life at this point, but then after I do that, if I can find something for myself to draw to put into it, it can make the story stronger, I think. Anytime you write for a show, you spend so much time with the characters day in and day out that you get to know. And when I'm looking for story ideas, like for MASH now, I'll say, you know, here's Hawkeye having been through what he's been through to this point, and standing right here right now, what can feasibly happen to him, and use like interaction with the other characters and stuff like that.
Do you ever feel like the well might run dry, that you won't be able to come up with another story?
Constantly. Every time I start a script, I'm determined I can't write anymore, and I always go crying my producer's shoulder. I don't know. I think that probably the same ideas are done over and over, but as long as you have different characters, that how they would handle that particular situation is always going to be different. I think there's so many vast experiences that I don't think there can ever be a possibility of running out of things to write about.
Well, you've worked primarily for Eight is Enough and for MASH, two of the most popular shows going. What do you think is the key to the success of these two shows?
Since Eight is Enough was just canceled, it's hard to say. I think that MASH's success, I'm determined that that has come from the fact that everybody involved with the show is concerned primarily with making the show the best it can be. Every time in a story meeting or watching it filmed or anything, it's like I've been on other shows where it seemed like a person's individual career was more important than the show as a whole, but at MASH, everybody's concerned with making the show the best it can possibly be. And I know I've heard actors on MASH say, you know, if this scene's going to be better because I'm not in it, then take me out of it, you know, which is really phenomenal for an actor who wants to be on the screen as much as possible.
Among all the stories and scripts you've written, does one stand out as your favorite?
There was an Eight is Enough that I wrote that's always been my favorite because it was really drawn from a strong personal experience. And it was about one of the daughters having to choose between her career and a marriage, and the whole thing with trying to deal with relationships and a career at the same time, especially right now for women, is something that hasn't been done often because it's the problem that's just cropping up. It was something I felt strongly about, so I think that was really my strongest show.
Well, which way is up for the story editor of MASH?
I don't know. You mean what do I want to do when I grow up? I really would like to get into producing, and I think that after a few years of doing what I have been doing, that I'll be ready to do that. Because most producers today are writers who have risen to be producers to have more creative control over what they do. So that's what I'd really like to do eventually. I want to stay in television because I really like television. I think that 90% of it is garbage, and I want to do the 10% that isn't.
This has been Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William and Mary and this station. Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William and Mary, and this station. Today's guest is Ben Carnevale, a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame and current athletic director at William and Mary. Our topic, intercollegiate athletics in the 80s, sport, business, or both. Mr. Carnevale, what would you say is the single most striking difference between college athletics today compared to college athletics when you began coaching college basketball in the 1940s?
Well, I think first, the financial aspects of the complete sports program, Mike. I think nowadays, with inflation and with the budget crunch on all athletic programs and in education in general, all of aspects of education, the cost of your tuition and all, it's just gotten to the point where you almost have to run it as a business to retain the program that you have.
Well, in the last decade, our sports pages have been filled with stories of under-the-table deals, forged transcripts, and a win-at-all-costs attitude in college sports. Are the problems of amateur intercollegiate sports being exaggerated, or are we just seeing the tip of an iceberg in these stories?
No, I don't think they're being exaggerated. They're just conditions that exist in certain institutions that have felt that in order to compete and be competitive and to win, they may have had to take that course, Mike. I think you'll find where you have a good athletic administrator, a good coach, and a good president, all that has an idea of what's going on in athletics and keeps their finger on the pulse. I don't think you'll find that possible. But there again, some institutions feel that they have to follow that course in order to win.
With the tremendous amounts of money being invested in big-time and even not-so-big-time college athletic programs today, it's clear that intercollegiate athletics is big business. How difficult is it to balance the moral standards of amateur athletics with the financial pressures of a big business?
Well, there again, I think if you have good administrators and good coaches that understand what your philosophy and what your policy is at any institution, Mike, I think by keeping up with the trends in the athletics and also retaining a sane view regarding the entire athletic program and trying to develop funds that maybe come from your alumni and develop a course that basically is more or less in line with the philosophy of the institution, Mike. I think that you have to decide basically where you're going and how you want to do it, and more or less run that program within those guidelines.
Well, is it possible to be successful in, say, Division I big-time athletics without compromising what people would call the moral standards of amateur sports?
Yes, I think so, but I think it takes certain conditions. You have to have the proper facilities, Mike. You have to develop a program that will develop the revenues that can pay for that program. I think that's one of the big problems we have here at William & Mary. Our football facility is just not large enough to attract the decent teams to come in here, and we can't pay the guarantees if we don't have that enlarged stadium.
Well, the athletic director at DePaul University recently resigned because he felt the university was placing too much emphasis on the money-making aspect of the school's successful basketball program. Are we seeing a trend toward more business-oriented athletic directors today?
I think you will, and I think it'll be part of the future too, Mike. I think because an athletic director coming in today has to develop revenues and finances to underwrite the cost of the program. And there again, I think with the advent of your new cable TV and TV programs and enlarged stadiums and your ticket costs, I think an athletic director today has to look at those areas, but do it within the guidelines, again, as I said earlier, regard the college's basic athletic policy.
Well, where do these men come from if they're no longer simply ex-players and coaches?
Well, I think they can come from the field of promotions. They can come from any area where they may have had the background to develop the program.
Well, where are college athletics headed in the next decade?
I think that the big problem that we do have is underwriting the cost of college athletics with inflation. I think that all of us, if you've seen in recent newspaper articles, all of us are looking at our programs very, very closely. Some of your largest and most successful institutions have had to drop certain sports. I think we're very, very fortunate here at the College of William & Mary and able to underwrite the cost of 15 men programs and 15 women programs, a total of 30 different athletic activities. We have been, very, very careful of how we spend our funds and our budget compared to many of the larger Division I institutions, just a small fraction of what they're spending. I know our budget is in the area of maybe $1.5 million, where you take some of the larger institutions that are spending $5 and $6 million to run their program. But basically, it's a matter of finances, and I think you have to get competent people that can develop those finances under the proper guideline and under the proper rules and under the NCAA or the AIAW and run their programs on that basis.
This has been Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William & Mary and this station. Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William & Mary and this station. Today's guest is Colonel Lawrence Beyer, director of the college's ROTC program. Our topic, ROTC Today, Rising from the Ashes. Colonel Beyer, in the early 1970s, our armed forces began to feel the pinch of anti-military sentiment among many of this country's young people. Enlistment dropped steadily, and with the end of the draft, our military forces found themselves short on qualified manpower. Did college and university ROTC programs follow the same pattern?
Yes, it did, Mike. The many ROTC programs faltered. Many ROTC programs declined in strength. Here locally at the College of William & Mary, the average cadet strength during the late 60s and early 70s was approximately 400. And declining to a number of about 65 in 1974.
Well, has there been a recent upsurge in interest among college students in ROTC programs?
Certainly has. From this low I was talking about in 1974 here locally, we've increased to approximately 240 today. And, of course, that includes men and women. Now, nationally, I think the figures have doubled approximately the same time, 1973, 1974. We had about 35,000, and today, the last fall, the opening enrollment was approximately 70,000 nationwide.
How do you explain this upsurge?
Both due to environmental factors and changes in the students themselves. First of all, concerning the environment, we've changed the program, restructured it. We emphasize adventure training. We're trying to get away from what I like to refer to as the Animal House image, where ROTC appeared to be cadets running around in uniform and playing the role of a soldier or martinet when they really didn't know what they were doing. That has never existed, because I know I was an ROTC cadet myself. However, that was a perception, especially promulgated by the Animal House, the movie itself, in that ilk. So we're getting away and trying to keep away from those type of activities which foster that image. There's also interest. We are trying harder to attract students because we know that we are competing with the commercial market. They do not have to come in the military service, so all the staff personnel at college and universities are well aware that they're in the recruiting business. Now, as far as the individual, the doldrums of the late 60s, early 70s have been overcome as far as the individuals. We find the average student wants to come back and is more patriotic today than he used to be. He is more conservative-minded, but he also has a perception that in the world we are in trouble. We have enemies against us, and we need to defend ourselves. We need to have the ability to defend ourselves. They believe this, and therefore they feel that they should defend their country, and secondarily, they also feel a need to serve their country. Very proud to be an American, and they feel a need to somehow pay back their country for their opportunities they have.
Has the recruiting approach of ROTC programs changed dramatically in recent years?
Well, since the late 60s and early 70s, I think the commonly, first of all, we didn't recruit that much. We had scholarship programs. We didn't recruit that much. And the idea was we offer military science. If you want military science, we, the cadre, if you want military science, then you didn't come to our program. We'll give it to you. Now, today, that's changed just diametrically opposite. Our program today is opposite from that. We want to attract students. We go our way to attract them. We publicize. We have national advertising programs, which we talked about earlier. And we want to prove that we can compete successfully as far as offering a career or at least early leadership training and opportunity to a wide variety of students. So we are going after an active program to go after the students rather than letting him come to us.
Well, some people thought ROTC on college campuses was near extinction a decade ago. Is it still an endangered species?
I would say it's not as bad off, and it will not continue to be bad off. It's improving every day, and I think the future would hold success for ROTC. We have to, in fact, have more officers for our armed services in the future.
This has been Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William and Mary and this station. Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William and Mary, and this station. Our guest today is Milena Hood, a senior ROTC cadet at the college. Today's topic, mixing college and the Army. Milena, what brought you into a college ROTC program?
Being at William and Mary brought me here. My first priority was to go to college. And the program was here. They had been sending me mailings during the summer that gave me an opportunity to look through it. When I got here, I was definitely not pro-Army. But then I heard about the opportunities and found out that if I did take a course, it would not be an obligated time. So I could just find out more information about the Army, and I'm always gaining to gain more knowledge.
Well, as a woman ROTC cadet, have you found any particular disadvantages in this program?
No. Not thus far. I haven't noticed any, and I haven't been around people that have showed me any bias because I'm a woman.
Do you anticipate any problems with being a woman in the future? Or are you ready to face them?
I anticipate some, and I'm always ready to face problems that hit me. I anticipate it not here in a program, but when I am commissioned, and if I do go active duty, because this Army was, excuse me, a man's Army, and it made a switch, and is always going to be that sentiment that this was for a man, and I don't expect it to change overnight, but I can deal with it.
How is a typical day for an ROTC student any different from the day of other college students?
Ooh. Our day can be more hectic, I think. I think we have more pressure on us because we're going to be commissioned to armed forces that protects this country. We are college students trying to take care of academic work, but also we are trying to learn the skills that are necessary in order to do the duties that we are expected in the future, and that's a lot of pressure.
Has the ROTC program changed at all since you first became a part of it?
We're trying to enlarge the student body here, and you have to make changes in the structure of the program in order to provide for the enlargement of students coming into it. The, for instance, we have weekend trips called FTX, which the student goes on, and it's trying to put us in a setting where we're actually being. Say during a wartime, we have exercises where we're actually handling guns to provide for a larger group being in this activity. You have to, I don't know, provide for food and everything. I mean, finances even have to change.
How has being a part of the ROTC program here affected your college experience?
It has affected it drastically. I have matured in areas I would have not had it not been for ROTC. College itself has been a big switch in my life. But ROTC has added a dimension like leadership. These skills will help me not only, I don't know, in a job market, but my life as an individual. I can better cope with a lot of things that I would have not had it not been for ROTC. It has added a dimension of discipline to my life. I mean, I do not get up early in the morning, and that FTX really shook me up.
Would you say students looking at colleges today are more interested in the ROTC programs than they were, say, 5 years ago?
Yes. Students today, I think, are more professional-minded. When we go to college, we expect to get something out that we can use in the future. ROTC will provide that, I think, in the benefits, not only in money. I came into ROTC because of the benefits they're going to give me, because of leadership skills and everything that I can use, and because I plan to be a lawyer, and I need to have a grasp of myself and who I am and what I'm going to do in the future, and it does help.
When you leave this program, you'll enter the Army as an officer. How do you feel about the quality of men you'll be leading, soldiers who are mostly products of an all-volunteer Army?
The government expect it. I'll think... I don't have any doubts that it would be like the trust would be there. We're all in this together. As I said, the government inspected as I had to go through a series of things to be initiated into the Army. I don't think I'd have any problem with the men unless they have problems with me as a woman.
This has been Williamsburg Weekly, a public service of the College of William and Mary and this station. Good night.